Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the October 27th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. Another entertaining drawing on the cover this week. There is a statue of a smiling former President Obama with his hands out to the side. And then below the statue is none other than Donald Trump. And he's swinging a sledgehammer as hard as he can. He's already knocked off one of the arms of the Obama statue. He's gritting his teeth and got his sleeves rolled up, his ties flying. And the title says, "A Smashing Success, Trump's Escalating Campaign to Erase Obama's Legacy." And that, I believe, is our first main story, and we'll start with that. The main stories and how they were covered. Trump targets Obamacare. What happened? Two U.S. senators unveiled a bipartisan proposal to fix parts of the Affordable Care Act this week after President Trump announced executive actions that critics said would sabotage the beleaguered health care law. The president's most significant move was ceasing about $10 billion in federal funding for cost-sharing reductions, key payments to health insurers that offset the cost of covering about 7 million low-income Americans through Obamacare. Under the compromise offered by Senators Lamar Alexander, Republican from Tennessee, and Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington, Congress would authorize funding for these payments for 2 years in exchange for giving states greater flexibility to regulate health coverage. If passed, the legislation would ease the review process for states that want waivers from some of the law's requirements and expand eligibility for catastrophic insurance, which is cheaper but less comprehensive than other ACA plans. The proposal would also provide $106 million in enrollment outreach funding, largely offsetting the Trump administration's recent effort to cut programs that seek to enroll the uninsured. Republican congressional leaders did not take a position on the Alexander Murray bill, and several GOP lawmakers came out against it, describing it as a means to prop up Obamacare. Trump initially called the proposal a very good deal, but a day later said Congress should find a solution to the Obamacare mess instead of providing bailouts to insurance companies. The president vowed to dismantle the Affordable Care Act and eventually replace it. "Obamacare is finished," Trump said. "It's dead. It's gone." What the editorial said: Trump's executive orders were a malicious attack on our health care system, said the Los Angeles Times. Obamacare works by offsetting the higher health care cost of older, sicker consumers with the premiums of younger, healthier people. Allowing too many of the young to leave the ACA's insurance pools will force insurers to raise premiums for everyone else. And halting the cost-sharing payments will force insurers to either steeply raise premiums or abandon the exchanges altogether. If Republicans don't pass the Alexander Murray proposal, they'll add roughly 20% to the premiums faced by millions of their constituents. Trump had good reason to cut the cost-sharing reductions, said NationalReview.com. They were illegal. Obamacare did not actually put up the money for payments, and when Congress refused to appropriate funding, the Obama administration sent the billions to insurers regardless. As for the introduction of cheaper health plans providing coverage only for hospitalizations, they could well raise premiums for older people. But that just underscores a key weakness of Obamacare. It's almost impossible to fix the law's flaws without threatening other parts of it. What the columnist said. It took almost a year, but we now have the, quote, Trump doctrine, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. On nearly every major issue, health care, the Iran nuclear deal, the Paris Climate Agreement, the Domestic Clean Power Initiative, the president's position is the same. Obama built it, I broke it, you fix it. His guiding motivation is to smash his predecessor's legacy, regardless of what happens the morning after. Trump's policy sabotage and his repeated insistence that Obamacare is imploding has already badly damaged the program, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. Polling shows that only 31% of customers insured through the ACA exchanges and 12% of the uninsured know that open enrollment starts on November 1st. Trump's false claim that Obamacare is finished will no doubt fuel this lack of awareness. I thought liberals wanted to reduce the number of uninsured, said Betsy McCaffey in the New York Post. Yet when Trump allows insurers to sell policies at half the price of, quote, bronze plans on the exchanges, they shout sabotage. The ACA's one-size-fits-all package is patently unfair for young, healthy people who rarely require medical treatment. Why should the healthy pay the same for insurance as the chronically ill? Trump thinks if he inflicts sufficient damage on Obamacare, he can blackmail Democrats into cutting a health care deal on his terms, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. But Republicans control both Congress and the White House, and if the health care system falls into chaos, the president and the GOP will absorb the blame. Trump is sabotaging himself. And we'll go on into a second main story this week. Drug czar nominee pulls out after opioid report. What happened? President Trump's nominee for drug czar withdrew his name from consideration this week after it was revealed that he'd sponsored an industry-friendly law that hobbled the DEA's efforts to combat the nation's opioid crisis. A joint Washington Post 60 Minutes investigation detailed how Representative Tom Marino, Republican from Pennsylvania, who'd been nominated to head the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, championed a 2016 bill that made it nearly impossible for drug enforcement officials to halt suspicious bulk shipments of painkillers to pharmacies and pain clinics. He and other sponsors argued the law would help ensure patients received medications they needed. But DEA officials who opposed the bill complained that it undercut their efforts against drug distributors who were flooding communities with highly addictive opioids. One West Virginia town with a population of just 372 people was sent 9 million hydrocodone pills over 2 years. At a White House press conference, Trump announced that he would declare the opioid crisis a national emergency next week, having first promised to make the declaration in August. The emergency designation would allow states to request more money for first responders and increase access to medications for addiction, among other measures. A bipartisan group of lawmakers said they would try to repeal the Marino-backed law. What the columnist said. The government has played a shameful role in America's opioid epidemic, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Since the Marino-sponsored law passed, the DEA has not been able to suspend a single suspicious shipment from an opiate distributor or manufacturer, even though overdose deaths are skyrocketing. It is difficult to find a clearer example of money's corrosive effects on politics, said Clarence Page in the Chicago Tribune. the drug industry spent $102 million lobbying Congress between 2014 and 2016, including nearly $100,000 given to Marino. That may be legal, but it looks like legal bribery at best. It seems Congress doesn't read a lot of bills before passing them, said Jack Hellner and AmericanThinker.com. This supposedly terrible law was passed by unanimous consent, a procedure reserved for bills considered non-controversial. President Obama signed it with zero objections. So when the Democrats criticize this White House for its opioid response, remember, someone who didn't cause the opioid crisis is Donald Trump. He is at least trying to clean up the mess Obama handed him. If Trump truly thinks the opioid crisis is a national emergency, he's not treating it like one, said Herman Lopez in Vox.com. Since he first promised action 2 months ago, more than 6,000 Americans have died of overdoses. The declaration of a national emergency would not be a cure-all, but it would be a start. It is time to stop employing euphemisms like crisis and emergency, said Matthew Walther in TheWeek.com. What we are really in the middle of is an opioid genocide. Drug companies are wrecking countless lives and ravaging communities to make money. And it is a judgment on this country that we all but ignore it. Our controversy of the week is titled, Trump. Is the president unraveling? When Senator Bob Corker likened the Trump White House to an adult daycare center last week, he was merely echoing what people close to the president are privately telling journalists, said Gabriel Sherman in VanityFair.com. 10 months into his chaotic presidency, White House insiders describe Trump as increasingly unfocused and unraveling, and say his top aides wage a daily battle to restrain his worst impulses. Growing public criticism of Trump's behavior, tweets, and other public comments, including the embarrassing revelation that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called him an effing moron, has left Trump consumed by dark moods. When Trump is heading down a particularly dangerous or vindictive path, Chief of Staff John Kelly and other cabinet officials will try to soothe his temper with flattery, said Ashley Parker in the Washington Post. Failing that, they will try to delay his final verdict by offering to study the issue, hoping he may reconsider after having some time to calm down. The president chafes at the impression that his aides coddle him or treat him like a wayward teenager, and resents that Kelly limits his access to sycophantic friends and family members. I hate everyone in the White House, Trump recently complained. This is getting scary, said Andrew Sullivan in NYMag.com. Trump's public behavior lately has shown a sharp decline even from his previously unhinged and malevolent incoherence. His executive sabotage of the healthcare system, his undermining of his own diplomats on Iran and North Korea, and his threats to punish TV networks and newspapers for stories he doesn't like are no longer part of any discernible agenda. He seems now to be a grouchy 71-year-old Fox News viewer lashing out at the world in a fit of mindless nihilism. The time for whispered criticism and quiet snickering is over, said Michael Gerson in WashingtonPost.com. It's time for Republican leaders and even Trump's loyal minders to address out loud the question on everybody's mind. Is Donald Trump psychologically and morally equipped to be president? Trump's critics need new material, said Molly Hemingway in TheFederalist.com. The wailing of liberals and Republicans and Republican never-Trumpers about his mental state has about as much resonance in 2017 as it did in 2016, when voters chose Trump as their next president. The haters' latest fantasy is that they'll persuade Trump's cabinet or supermajorities in Congress to invoke the 25th Amendment, declare him incapable of performing his duties, and remove him from office. Dream on. The Republican base still supports Trump, who is succeeding in promoting religious freedom, curtailing burdensome regulation, and pursuing a conservative agenda. There is more method to his madness than his enemies understand, said Howard Fineman in HuffingtonPost.com. While Trump's critics focus on the chaos, his administration is working steadily to fill the judiciary with conservatives, dismantle President Obama's legacy, and lay the groundwork for his reelection. Trump may or may not be unraveling, said Michael Cohen in the Boston Globe, but the rest of us surely are. It's simply impossible to keep up with the daily torrent of outrages, threats, lies, and policy reversals emanating from this White House. For millions of Americans, the emotional toll of Trumpism is mounting, with people reporting increased anxiety, depression, insomnia, weight gain, and a debilitating sense of hopelessness. Many worry that this unhinged man will start a nuclear war. Trump has become an unbearable, infuriating, enraging, and draining presence in our national life. Could this possibly go on for three more years? And on a hopefully lighter note, we'll go to our good week, bad week short pieces. Let's see what we've got today. It was a good week for political outsiders, with reports that a Republican congressional candidate from Miami, Bettina Rodriguez Aguilera, has claimed that she was abducted by aliens when she was seven. Rodriguez Aguilera, 59, says the aliens were tall and blonde and that their spaceship was powered by quartz rocks, not like airplanes. It was a good week for social media backlashes after HalloweenCostumes.com agreed to stop selling an Anne Frank costume in response to an avalanche of criticism. The site's ad showed a smiling child model and described Frank as an inspiration to us all. And it was a good week for Robert Mueller after Hustler publisher Larry Flint took out a full-page ad in the Washington Post offering $10 million for information leading to the impeachment of President Trump. "We need to flush everything out into the open," Flint wrote in the ad. But it was a bad week for remaining calm after police in Bothell, Washington, requested that residents please stop dialing 911 to report that they can't log on to Facebook. "We will move mountains to help those in our community," said a police spokesman. "However, we can't fix Facebook." It was a bad week for the price of gold after astronomers observing the collision of two neutron stars in a distant galaxy estimated that $10 octillion dollars worth of gold was created by the violent impact. Fortunately or unfortunately, the gold is 130 million light years away. And finally, it was a bad week for trick-or-treaters after creationists in Kentucky began distributing fake $1 million bills to be given to kids on Halloween. Have you ever lied, stolen, or used God's name in vain, the bills say? The penalty for your crimes against God is death and eternal hell. We're on the briefing page now. It's titled, Armed and Dangerous. Would tighter gun control laws reduce America's unparalleled levels of gun violence? How severe is the problem? It's worse than in any other nation in the civilized world. Every day, an average of 300 Americans are shot. There were 36,252 firearm deaths in the U.S. in 2015, including 22,018 suicides and 12,979 homicides, and at least 85,000 injuries. Every day, an average of nearly two women are shot dead by their partners. Nearly 6,000 children are shot each year, a fifth accidentally, with 1,300 fatalities. Since 1982, there have been 81 mass shootings, using the definition in which four or more victims die in a public incident, including three this year. Under an alternative definition of four or more people shot in one incident, there have been 273 mass shootings so far this year. Over the past 50 years, more Americans have been killed by guns than in all the wars in the nation's history. The U.S. suffers disproportionately from firearms, said Aaron Grinstein, author of a recent study on U.S. gun violence. They are killing us rather than protecting us. Does gun control work? The majority of research here and abroad strongly indicates that while gun restrictions are no panacea, they do reduce the casualty count. A 2016 Columbia University review of 130 studies in 10 countries concluded that passing new gun laws generally leads to a significant drop in homicides and suicides. State laws point to the same conclusion. Most of the states with the highest rates of firearm deaths, such as Alaska and Louisiana, have loose restrictions. Most of those with the lowest rates, such as Massachusetts and Hawaii, have much stricter laws. Firearm assaults are 6.8 times more common in the states that have the most guns, compared with those that have the fewest. Since Australia responded to the 1996 Port Arthur massacre by banning semi-automatic rifles and shotguns, requiring that all weapons be registered, and buying back about 700,000 guns from citizens, firearm homicides have plunged by more than 50%, and the country hasn't had another mass shooting since. For years, gun control advocates have cited these statistics in arguing for stricter federal gun control laws in the U.S. What have they proposed? The most popular proposal, one supported by 85% of gun owners, is to expand mandatory background checks to all firearm sales, not just those involving licensed dealers, to make it harder for criminals and the mentally ill to buy firearms at gun shows or directly from individual sellers. Currently, one in five gun sales is completed without a background check. Two other possible measures are barring gun sales to people who have been arrested for domestic violence and barring sales to those on terrorist watch lists. Both are opposed by the National Rifle Association, NRA, on due process grounds. Democratic lawmakers have tried without success to outlaw high-capacity magazines, which enable shooters to fire as many as 100 bullets without reloading, after they were used in the massacres at Newtown, Aurora, and Las Vegas. But all of these proposals, as well as proposed bans on assault-style weapons, also recently favored by mass shooters, have been blocked by gun rights advocates. On what grounds? The NRA and other opponents of restrictions argue that violent crime rates have dropped about 50% over the past two decades, a period when the number of guns in the country has steeply increased to about 310 million. The proportion of households with guns has dropped dramatically, however, from 53% in 1994 to 36% last year. The government's National Crime Victimization Survey has calculated that Americans brandish or fire guns in self-defense at least 65,000 times a year. Gun rights advocates claim many more incidents go unreported and that criminals are deterred merely by the prospect that a potential victim might be armed. The NRA says the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, although a 2014 FBI study found that in 160 active shooter incidents, armed members of the public stopped the gunman only once. Could more gun laws be passed? Republican lawmakers say they might support a ban on the bump stock, the device Las Vegas shooter Stephen Paddock used to fire his semi-automatic rifles like a machine gun. But few dare cross the powerful NRA, which campaigns hard against politicians who back any gun law. At its heart, America's gun control debate is a conflict over culture and rights. Gun rights advocates insist restrictions would intrude on law-abiding citizens' constitutional right to bear arms and with little impact on the criminal use of weapons. Gun control advocates argue that all rights are limited to some extent and that reasonable restrictions would be justified even if they only incrementally reduce the death toll, saving a few hundred or a few thousand times a year. No one law is going to say, "Hey, now we've eliminated this problem," said Daniel Hemingway, who has extensively studied gun control at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. "But if you did a lot of things, it would be a great help." Crossing the NRA. Republican politicians aren't the only ones who dare not defy the NRA. In 2000, Smith & Wesson agreed to a deal with the Clinton administration to develop a smart gun and help prevent firearms from falling into criminals' hands. The NRA was incensed, denouncing the company as the first gun maker to run up the white flag of surrender. The organization released the CEO's phone number and encouraged its members to complain. "So many death threats followed. I'm a dead-on shot," one caller told him, that another executive took to wearing a bulletproof vest. When the NRA then initiated a boycott of Smith & Wesson, it prompted a sales drop off so severe that two factories temporarily shut down and the company's stock plunged 95% in 10 months. Smith & Wesson has since repaired its relationship with the NRA and hasn't forgotten its ill-fated attempt to compromise. "It almost took down the company," says current CEO James Debney. "We won't make that mistake again." Time to read a few columns. This first from the U.S. Indifference in the face of genocide. After the Holocaust, much of the Western world adopted the slogan, "Never again." But our collective vow to stop genocides has always been more theoretical than actual, as we're seeing once again in Myanmar, also known as Burma. The government's forced expulsion of the country's Rohingya Muslims from their homeland has been sickeningly brutal, with thousands of people slaughtered and hundreds of thousands fleeing across the border to squalid camps in Bangladesh. Last week, a Rohingya woman told journalists how Myanmar soldiers clubbed her in the face, tore her screaming infant from her arms, and threw him into a fire. While the child burned to death, the gang raped her. There is only one way to stop ongoing acts of genocide, such as this, which periodically reoccur throughout the world: the application of American military force. But the American public feels burned by past interventions abroad and has no interest in sending troops or spending money to stop mass atrocities in Southeast Asia or Africa or the Middle East. We don't see such interventions as worth the costs, so we do nothing. When we make that choice, we expose never again as the lie it always was. This is from Austria. A young leader shifts the country rightward. Austria's likely new chancellor is an energetic young political entrepreneur, said Peter Ulrim. In 2013, at age 27, Sebastian Kurz became the country's youngest ever foreign minister. Last week, the now 31-year-old Kurz led the center-right People's Party to first place in Austria's national election, winning 31% of the vote. Before Kurz took over as party leader last May, polls showed the far-right Freedom Party, founded by ex-Nazis, with a clear lead. But the Freedom Party ended up finishing a hair behind the center-left Social Democrats, each getting about 27%. Far-right leader Hans Christian Strache claimed Kurz stole his supporters by adopting his anti-immigrant, tough-on-crime platform, but that can't be the whole story, since the Freedom Party also picked up votes. Austrians flocked to Kurz partly for his low-tax populism and partly because they credit the foreign minister with halting the flow of migrants through the country in 2015. Kurz will now be given the first chance to try to form a government, probably with the Freedom Party as a junior coalition partner. If he succeeds, the Wunderkind will become one of the world's youngest national leaders. It's a tectonic shift in Austrian politics, said Joachim Riedel. The election marked not just the rise of the right, but also the collapse of the left. It's only the second time since 1966 that the Social Democrats haven't won a plurality of the votes, and the Greens completely imploded, thanks to a party split. The People's Party triumph is all the more notable given that the youthful Kurz didn't win the youth vote. Under 29s plumped for the Freedom Party, possibly turned off by Kurz's tendency to come across as a know-it-all teacher's pet. The People's Party is supposed to be center-right, said Paolo Valentino. But with Kurz at the helm, there's hardly any difference because it and the ultranationalist Freedom Party, between it and the ultranationalist Freedom Party. Both parties want to strengthen border security and ban Muslim immigrants. In outlook and policy, Kurz is far closer to authoritarian Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban than he is to German Chancellor Angela Merkel. His ascent in Austria is yet another sign that once moderate conservative parties are willing to mimic the far right's hard line on migrants, Islam, and internal security. Yet Europe simply accepts this, said The Guardian in an editorial. The last time the Freedom Party entered government with the People's Party, in 2000, an appalled European Union imposed diplomatic sanctions, and Israel withdrew its ambassador. This time, international calls to treat any Austrian government that includes the Freedom Party as a pariah are conspicuous by their absence. Maybe that's because such an outcome seems inevitable. Kurz forced this election by taking his party out of a ruling coalition with the Social Democrats, so he can hardly partner with them now. The only other option is for the Social Democrats to team up with the Freedom Party. Whatever form the new government takes, it will be sharply nationalistic. And this from Russia: why we accept our repression. Russians today are as apathetic and resigned as they were during Soviet time, said Eva Hartog and Lev Gudkov. Under Communist Party rule, the typical citizen was deeply mistrustful, not only of the state, but of everyone apart from his immediate family. The adage, "They pretend to pay us, we pretend to work," was the unspoken motto of Homo Sovieticus, because he knew how to evade the demands of the authorities while simultaneously maintaining informal and corrupt relations with them. During the chaos of the early post-Soviet years, the average Russian was adrift, aghast at his sudden job insecurity and embarrassed about his country's poverty and historical crimes. Then came Vladimir Putin to restore his sense of dignity. Putin assured Russians that every country had skeletons in the closet, nothing to be ashamed of. Most important, he returned the state to its role as a paternalistic caretaker. The modern Russian is now very much like Homo Sovieticus, only with a car and nicer clothes. He doesn't think he can change the government and doesn't want to try. Knowing corruption is everywhere, he has learned to adapt and make deals with the authorities. Young Russians may occasionally protest, but they are soon co-opted into a system of compromise and cynicism. It will take more than one generation to change that. Our last word article takes us to another politician, but one who hasn't been in the news so much recently. Blagojevich behind bars. 5 years ago, former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich reported to a federal prison in Colorado to start a 14-year sentence for corruption, said journalist David Bernstein. In his first prison interview, he details life on the inside. Rod Blagojevich's first summer in prison was, he recalls, quite an awakening. He had arrived at the low-security prison in Jefferson County, Colorado, 15 miles southwest of Denver, in the spring, when there was still a mountain chill in the air. But that year, 2012, Denver experienced its hottest summer on record. At the time, the former Illinois governor was housed in a dorm room with nearly 100 other inmates. The room was essentially a long, narrow hallway partitioned into 10-man cubicles. Metal bunks lined the walls, jammed in tight. Blagojevich slept on a top bunk. It was extremely close quarters, he notes. Just a lot of men with a lot of noise, bad sounds, and bad smells. Blagojevich is telling me this story in an email. It is the first time since being incarcerated more than 5.5 years ago that he has been interviewed. The facility didn't have air conditioning either, he continues. The heat was oppressive. Sleeping in that heat was almost impossible. To cool down, he employed a prison trick. He emptied out the contents from the plastic bag of cereal he purchased from the commissary and filled it with ice right before evening lockdown. Prison officials brought in several large fans and placed them around the room, but there weren't enough to make much difference. The biggest and toughest inmates, he remembers, would turn the fans to blow toward themselves. Blagojevich sums up the experience this way. Extreme heat, drenched in sweat, with no air movement, scores of angry men, snoring and other bad, unpleasant sounds. I remember moaning to myself, how the blank did I end up here? For many of us, the last images we carry of Rod Blagojevich are from March 15th, 2012. The sun had yet to rise when the former governor opened the door of his house in Chicago's Ravenswood Manor neighborhood and bounded down the front steps toward a waiting car. He was leaving to catch a flight to Denver to start serving his 14-year prison sentence for corruption. The most sensational of the 18 federal counts had been him trying to hawk Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat for campaign contributions or political favors. Five of those counts were tossed on appeal in 2015, though his sentence was not reduced. 5 years, 2 months, and 8 days later, on a May afternoon, a call with a 303 area code pops up on my cell phone. My phone interview with Rod Blagojevich, inmate 40892-424, was scheduled for 2 p.m., but it's only 1:51. Rod Blagojevich, early? While governor, he was chronically and unapologetically late for events, if he showed up at all. But here he was, early, on the other end of the line. Weeks before, Blagojevich had agreed to an in-person visit, but officials at FCI Inglewood denied the request. They allowed instead two telephone interviews, a 30-minute call in May and an hour-long one in July. Those conversations, as well as six lengthy emails Blagojevich sent me by his lawyer and several interviews with his wife, Patty, offered detailed glimpses into his life behind bars, his relationship with his wife and two daughters, and his thoughts on the future. I begin our May call by noting that many people presume he's at Club Fed. Blagojevich responds that it feels nothing like a vacation. It's really a prison. Opened in 1940, FCI Inglewood sits on 320 acres in the foothills of the snow-capped Rocky Mountains next to Littleton, Colorado. The low-security facility where Blagojevich began his sentence houses some 920 prisoners. If it weren't for the guards armed with assault rifles and the razor wire encircling it, one might mistake FCI Inglewood for a suburban high school. On the same campus is the less restrictive minimum security prison where Blagojevich was transferred in November 2014 and now resides, along with 170-plus other inmates. Blagoya asked to serve his time at FCI Inglewood for several reasons. For starters, it's one of the few federal prisons to house both low-security and minimum-security facilities. This is important because it makes it quicker and easier for inmates to transfer from one to the other. Second, while there are several low-security prisons much closer to Chicago, FCI Inglewood's proximity to Denver's airport actually makes it easier for Blagojevich's family to visit. Third, as Patty Blagojevich points out, Forbes once ranked FCI's Inglewood among the 12 best places to go to prison. It is one of the least violent and least crowded federal sites. Last but not least important for the inmate, it is the inordinate number of days the sun peaks out in Colorado, which Blagojevich thought would help him stay upbeat. Still, the long sentence has weighed heavily on him. "It's a terrifying prospect," he says. "I can't lie." He won't be eligible for early release until he serves a little more than 12 years. He will be 68 then. Boosting his spirits have been the hundreds of letters he says he's received, most of which are supportive. Then he allows, "I occasionally get a bad one." He tells me about a letter from a woman from Champaign, Illinois. She had been working in state government in 2003 when, on Blagojevich's first full day as a governor, he fired dozens of his predecessor's political appointees, including her. "She basically waits about 13 years to write me, and I'm in this deep, dark valley," and she says, "I hope you're somebody's you-know-what in prison jargon. It was kind of funny." Blagojevich served 32 months at the low-security facility, the first 18 of them in the dorm-style room with the general prison population. His living situation improved greatly when he was moved to the adjoining minimum-security camp, or outside the fence, as the prisoners refer to the site, because it has no outer barriers. Inmates with less than 10 years on their sentences and who are considered low risk for escape are eligible. It's night and day between inside the fence and outside the fence, Blagojevich says. Converted from a motel that served those visiting FCI Englewood prisoners, the camp is a boomerang-shaped building with about 50 rooms. Those rooms, which sleep five, are carpeted and have bathrooms with tubs, which Blagojevich likes to use after long runs. Inmates are given much more freedom, and there is only one guard on duty each shift. There's lots of room for shenanigans, says one of Blagojevich's former cellmates. At night, after the final count, inmates have been known to venture off to Walmart to buy cigarettes. Some have even headed out to the golf course for tryst with girlfriends. The looser vibe took Patty by surprise initially. She recalls the first time she and her daughters visited her husband at the camp. As they were driving off, they noticed Blagojevich by the side of the road, waving to them. I was like, oh my God, this is the first time I've seen you outside in years, Patty recalls. I just wanted to say, jump in the car. Let's go home. For Blagojevich, a man who rose to political heights from modest roots, he is the son of a Serbian-born steel worker and a Chicago rail ticket clerk. Prison has been a humbling experience, full of little indignities. As at most correctional facilities, inmates are assigned menial jobs. At the low-security facility, Blagojevich did a three-month stint in the kitchen, one of the toughest tasks, but primarily worked in the law library and taught classes on the Civil War and World War II. His current job as an orderly at the camp pays $8.40 a month. My jurisdiction was once all of the state of Illinois. Now I've got two hallways to clean, he says. Blagojevich has come to savor the small acts of kindness. On his first day, he tells me, a group of inmates presented him with a big house version of a welcome basket. They took up a collection and put together a gift bag. Among the items were coffee, a couple of plastic mugs, and a toothbrush. It was really kind of touching. You know, these are big, tough guys, drug dealers and gangbangers and bank robbers. They have so little, right? And it's a sweet thing that they did, welcoming you to their world. For mental and emotional fortitude behind bars, he has turned to religion. I've had a chance in prison over these many years to get closer, stronger in my faith, said Blagojevich, once an altar boy at his Serbian Orthodox church. The lessons from the Bible and Scripture have been very helpful to me. It's strengthened my strength. It's also strengthened my resolve. It's convinced me further that I know what I'm doing is right. In prison, nearly everyone has a nickname. In my housing unit alone, Blagojevich says, there was Smelly, Socks, Sharky, V, Mr. B, and Boo Boo. Blagojevich's nickname? Gov, naturally. Nevertheless, he hardly runs the joint. Once a gifted glad-hander as a politician, Blagojevich is largely a loner as an inmate. You got to navigate carefully. You got to deal with the politics of prison, and you got to be careful with that, he says, explaining why he mostly keeps to himself. Patty tells me that while her husband has gotten close to some white-collar offenders, he'd rather socialize with other inmates. He far prefers the honest drug dealer to the con artist guys. I ask if he's lonely. Well, of course, yeah, he replies softly. Years of loneliness and affliction, yearning for home, missing my family. But I'm okay. Much of his day is devoted to reading, writing, and exercising. He cracks open the Bible daily. It's the first thing I do in the morning, he says. Read it. Reread it. Understand it better. During our conversation in May, he tells me he is absorbed in Stephen Ambrose's Undaunted Courage, about Lewis and Clark's exploration of the Louisiana Territory, as well as Strength to Love, a collection of Martin Luther King Jr.'s sermons. Most nights, Blagojevich reads until 2 or 3 o'clock. using a tiny book light he bought at the commissary. He calls the time his Winston Churchill hours because Churchill did some of his best writing in the wee hours of the morning. During one of our phone calls, I asked Blagojevich whether he would do anything differently if he could. Maybe I had too much pride, he says. I know I could have been more humble. I could have been less combative. I ask him if he's ever envisions making a political return. He laughs, hesitant to answer. The headline will be, Blago Predicts Comeback. Then he adds that he's read Nelson Mandela's biography twice. I'm not comparing myself to Mandela by any means, but it's inspirational to read about a guy who had to sit through prison for 27 years. Look what happened to him and his political career. I'm not making any comparison there, okay, other than to say that through him and a lot of others, I get inspiration, and it helps to give me the strength to endure. My elder daughter accuses me of being excessively optimistic, but I do believe in second acts. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Chicago Magazine. On the health and science page, we have Neanderthal genes influence. Before they disappeared some 40,000 years ago, Neanderthals interbred with humans, mixing their DNA with ours. Today, Neanderthal genes make up between 1 and 3% of the genetic code of most people with European and Asian ancestry. And a new study says these genes influence how they look, feel, and act, reports the Associated Press. Scientists in Germany analyzed the DNA of a Neanderthal specimen found in the mountains of Siberia and compared it with the genetic data, appearance, and behavior of 112,338 people with British ancestry. People of pure African descent have virtually no Neanderthal DNA because their ancestors didn't migrate to Europe. The researchers found that Neanderthal DNA influences 15 modern human traits, including hair color and skin tone, susceptibility to sunburn, and a tendency to be an evening person. Genes passed down from modern humans, shorter and stockier cousins, were also associated with higher rates of loneliness and moodiness. Most of the traits correlate to how much exposure to sunlight you have, says study author Michael Dannenman. Neanderthals had already adapted to the relatively low and varying levels of sunlight in Europe when they mated with modern humans, the researchers explain. They caution that the influence of genes is a subtle and complex, and that dozens or hundreds of genes can play a role in a trait. Potassium protects the heart. People often eat bananas, avocados, and leafy greens for various health benefits. New research adds another benefit. These and other potassium-rich foods may help prevent heart disease, ScienceDaily.com reports. Researchers at the University of Alabama at Birmingham found that a high potassium diet makes arteries more flexible and thus could reduce the risk of atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries. For the study, the researchers fed mice with a genetic susceptibility to heart disease a diet with low, normal, or high levels of potassium. The mice on the low potassium diet had more severe narrowing and hardening of the arteries than those with adequate potassium intake. High potassium diets had the opposite effect, suggesting that potassium-rich foods, which also include potatoes, spinach, carrots, and artichokes, could also help people prevent heart disease. And we'll just go into a few shorter notes to finish out the show today. Let's see. America's obesity epidemic has reached a new peak. A record 40% of adults and about 20% of adolescents are obese, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In total, about 70% of Americans are either overweight or obese. An epidemic of anxiety and depression is affecting American teenagers. In 1985, 18% of incoming college freshmen said they felt overwhelmed by all I had to do the previous year. By last year, that number had surged to 41%. Hospital admissions for suicidal teenagers have doubled over the past decade. A welcome to Key West sign that went missing during Hurricane Irma has been found 300 miles away in Fort Myers Beach. Crime in Japan has become so rare that police often have nothing to do. In 2015, there was just one gun homicide. Firearms are virtually illegal there. President Trump's reelection campaign spent more than $1 million on legal fees between July 1st and September 30th, nearly double the total spent during the previous quarter. The Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee have now made more than $2 million this year in payments to law firms and to lawyers representing the president and his family in the Russia investigation being pursued by Special Counsel Robert Mueller and several congressional committees. On the poll watch, in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein sexual assault scandal, 64% of Americans now consider sexual harassment in the workplace a serious problem, up from 47% in 2011. And we'll finish out today with a quote. This is from Joan Didion, quoted in InvestorBusinessDaily.com. She says, "There's a point when you've got to go with what you've got, or you don't go." We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.